It's time.
We are not called to be nice.
Sandy Rios. Welcome, Sandy. Thanks for being here.
We are often called to be confrontational.
And here with me in D.C. is Fox News contributor Sandy Rios.
And you still like me or you don't like me, James?
Are you okay? You're all right.
I'm a musician. I can't help it.
Longtime Fox News contributor Sandy Rios, thanks very much for being with us.
We have, I think it's 4-1 youth in America wants gay marriage.
Our kids are the product of public schools. No wonder they poll the way they do.
It's time to stand up or we're going to lose everything we have.
Director of Governmental Affairs for the American Family Association.
Step up, speak up, say something, do something.
This isn't a game. This is real life.
Sandy Rios is with the American Family Association.
A pro-life radio talk show host.
Some things are worth fighting for.
They would be alarmed by the hardening resentment we see towards immigrants and refugees and minority groups, especially Muslims, by the growing inability and even unwillingness to separate truth from lies that more and more of our fellow citizens seem to be flirting with authoritarianism.
All right, that was John McCain he was in Germany at a conference. And, of course, we know John McCain's views on immigration, and they are, you know, he lives in a border state, and yet he's not very concerned about all the people coming across the border and harming the ranchers where, he's supposed to be protecting. Bob Dana is with me. Bob and I have been friends for years because I've been honored to be on their radio row every year for how many years, Bob, have you had the radio?
10.
10 years. So this will be the 10th year. It's Federation for American Immigration Reform. They are sort of the think tank for the immigration issue.
We think deeply.
Yeah, yes, you do. You publish great information, trustworthy, and you've helped to educate the American people and change the landscape. Bob, did you ever think a year ago we would be in the position we are now, with a Donald Trump as president, a wall in process of being built, new agents being hired? Did you ever think it would be that way?
You know, last year I think I was wrong about virtually every political dynamic. It was a very humbling year. The only thing that keeps me going is I know that I was not alone. Look, I don't think we had an election last year as much as we had an earthquake. And that seismic shift was really the American public calling into question, collapsing all of the faulty foundations upon which the elites have stood, arrogantly firm-footed, dictating our immigration policies for their own grotesque and greedy needs. And the American voter stood up and said, this isn't working. And they said no to immigration for instant votes for the Democrats. The American public said no to immigration for the so-called cheap labor. And the American public really repudiated this idea that globalism helps the middle class. So they had a clear choice. There were stark policy choices between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. And you had a lot of folks vote hesitantly for Donald Trump, but we are now in a very, very good position. I will say this, one caveat. This election of Donald Trump, in terms of ushering in new, true immigration reform, it's not a victory in and of itself, but it sure is a good opportunity.
No question about it. And speaking of just people and their views, the American people, I'm just thinking, Bob, again, when you first started, when I got acquainted with you, this before you did the Radio Rose, actually, but during the Bush administration, there was this upheaval. There was this advancement of opening up the borders between the South and the North, and it was an advancement of open immigration and more HB1 visas. And we were just beginning to say, no, this is too much. And yet the Bush administration was tone deaf. And it was only an uprising of the people that stopped President Bush from doing more than he would have done on this issue. And so it's been a continual fight in which we felt like we were losing ground, I mean the people. I'm saying we the people. It's been the people that have really stopped this at every turn. And it's been, you know, your voice at FAIR and others, Numbers USA, holding the line, and people like me, radio talk show hosts around the country, trying to present information. I find it really interesting that last week after the first immigration, well, maybe 2 weeks ago after the first immigration order was issued, Rasmussen did a poll, and 55% of the American people, likely voters, that means everybody, felt that they approved of his job performance. 55%, just a couple of days after that, all of that week of bad publicity on the first.
That is true, and they still approve of that. And there are other polls that affirm that. Although, if you were to watch television tonight, or open your mainstream media newspaper in any city across the country, you would think that what is going on is draconian and somehow over the top. You know, one of the things that I've noticed over the last 10 years, of course, has been a ratcheting down of enforcement, a whittling away of interior and perimeter enforcement, the rise of executive power by a president who uses his power to thwart and usurp the congressional mandates. But one of the major changes that has occurred over the last 10 years, which is really the most diabolical tactic that Obama has left us with to clean up, and that is, Sandy, President Obama has changed the way that we in America think about immigration. In other words, if you're an illegal alien, unless you've committed a violent felony or you somehow represent a national security threat, it seems to be the new narrative, particularly for younger folks, is that violating immigration laws in and of themselves is now entirely inconsequential. That is going to take a little while to sort of reprogram that. I mean, think about it. If you were 14 years of age during a very impressionable time of life when President Obama came into office, you're now, 22. So you've got that in your head. And you're reading about the reassertion of the American authority to regulate our immigration policies. And the media is torquing it up and amplifying that this is draconian and somehow over the top. Look, all Trump is doing is getting the train back on the tracks. Back to the historical and norms that we've had in the United States. He is using the authority vested to him to basically tell law enforcement, hey, you can now do your job as Congress originally intended. It's simply hitting the reset button.
You know what really struck me a few years ago? I read about Mexico's immigration policy. I can't recite the details, except I remember that foreign citizens cannot own property. That you can't get a job if you're not a Mexican national. And it goes on. It was just amazing because Mexico has been the country which we've had such a porous border. And that's not the only problem we have with immigration, but their own laws are unbelievably strict about immigration compared to ours. And I think that's a real sobering rule for people to relearn and then understand that America's laws make perfect sense. But, Bob, by the time you and I, this is airing, it will be later. And I'm thinking that the second immigration order may have gone out by the time people are hearing this conversation. What do you know about that second order that the president is expected to sign and how it will affect our immigration policy?
Well, in summary, you've already had two executive orders that address interior and border enforcement, and it's restoring the 287G program and secure communities, and it's building the wall. And it's also adding 5,000 Border Patrol agents, 10,000 ICE agents. Those orders came out about 2 weeks ago, and they were broad in nature. They telegraphed the intentions of the president. He just, within the last 2 days, issued two new executive orders that gave more meat and potatoes and told his infrastructure and his agencies what they need to do. There was also another executive order, the refugee ban. That obviously got held up by a court, and it's put on hold. We expect Friday afternoon, late, to have that reissued. Here's my thinking. I put on my political analyst hat. I think what the president is going to do is not rescind the previous refugee order. He's going to fight that through the courts. Then he's going to lay in another refugee executive order that addresses the court's concern. And then he's going to run down the clock and request a lot of delays, because eventually we're going to have a new Supreme Court justice. So by the time the appeals take place, you just basically run down the clock for several months with filings and so forth. Then you get to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court probably would, recognize that the president does have full constitutional, regulatory, and statutory authority to determine who's coming into the country under what terms and to deny the entry of someone or a class of aliens who he deems detrimental to the national interest.
But only just because the justice in Washington State stopped portions of that first order. A lot of it has been implemented, as I understand it. Some really good things.
In terms of the refugee ban, the one thing the court did not strike down is the new cap on the number of refugees coming in. Over the last few years, the president had taken the number of refugees that are admitted into the United States from 50,000 up to 110,000. The new executive order does take that cap back down to 50. Here's the main point about this refugee ban. You know, how it plays out in the court is almost immaterial. We have been going through a period of nonstop illegal immigration, rising legal immigration, rising national security threats, with very little vetting. Is it so much to ask that we simply have a brief timeout? I mean, occasionally you need to take your car into the garage, open up the hood, do a tune-up, and we'll get back on track. But the American public obviously needs to understand that the extension of our compassion does not come at the expense of our security. And in fact, just one more thought. I mean, the admittance of refugees, those who truly face persecution by their host government, it's part of the backbone of our American compassion. I think we all want to continue that. But we will all be more comfortable continuing that into the future if we know that the system, the screening, and the vetting is safe. It is not, it can be, but we need a timeout. Got to get the car in the garage, up on the jacks, and tweak it.
Bob, Senator Cotton and another congressman who doesn't come to mind have presented a bill to limit immigration all across the board, legal immigration. What do you know about that and its chances of passing?
We've been waiting a long time for this. There's always been this sort of kink in the conservative brains that illegal immigration bad, legal immigration good. But if you take a look at the broad trajectory of the last 20, 30 years, I mean, we're admitting 1.2 million legal immigrants every year, mostly from third world countries. We've got one and a half.
That started under Bill Clinton, didn't it?
Yeah, yeah. You've got almost 13 million illegal immigrants in the United States, half of them occupying jobs that they have no legal right to. And on top of that, we're adding in 900,000 foreign guest workers each and every year. So, you know, there, if you reduce immigration, you tighten the labor market. I mean, one of the broad goals that this new president has is to put Americans back to work and increase wages. And one of the strong instruments that you use to tighten the labor market is to cut immigration.
Yeah, so, all right, so this bill, then, it's a common sense bill. So Senator Cotton has introduced it, but what do you think? I mean, do you think that, what's your sense of what's going to happen? The Senate is the worst body, the least likely probably to embrace this.
Oh,
the House leadership is bad, too.
Look, we're in a very good place, but moving forward, there are all kinds of obstacles. First of all, you've got all of the usual special interest. Nothing new there, except they will torque it up and amplify it by a factor of 10, complicit with the media. You do have the GOP, which is always splits itself over this issue of immigration, whether it's illegal or legal immigration. And by the way, Sandy, what, you know, one of the obstacles may be in April when Congress begins to put the new budget together. President Trump is going to have to present them with the bill of, you know, you, in order to animate a lot of his executive orders and to hire new Border Patrol agents and to hire new ICE agents, it's going to take public taxpayer money. So how are the GOP hawks going to face down with Trump's desire to expand enforcement? I would say this, at almost at whatever cost, it's a worthy investment, because illegal immigration costs Americans, you and I, $113 billion a year. So if we're going to spend $20 billion on the fence, maybe another $10 billion on additional resources, it's still a good investment.
Bob, I just saw a pundit from Cato Institute on with Tucker Carlson a couple of nights ago on Fox, and he was arguing how good immigration is for this country and how more people come in, they pay more taxes, and then they have families, and their family members pay more taxes, and it's good for us economically. I wish you had been debating him. What would you have said?
I think we need less immigration to tighten the labor market and get wages up. And the immigration we do have should be skilled. And skilled immigrants tend to be immigrants who also assimilate.
Oh, that makes a lot of sense. But I just don't see how they can look at the numbers and tell us that this kind of immigration is good for our economy. It's terrible. We know this. People have lost jobs. It's been a very hard time for the American people. But you know what? I look forward to being with you on your radio row this spring. It's Federation for American Immigration Reform, and they have really been holding the Congress persons and the president's feet to the fire, and I've been trying to help them do that. So, Bob, thanks for all you've done.
Thanks, Sandy. That. We'll see you in Washington in June.
Absolutely. All right, Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.
Sandy Rios in the morning on American Family Radio.
All right, Sandy Rios back with you at the Gaylord Hotel. This very noisy place, but lots of good noise going on here. Kellyanne Conway just spoke a few minutes ago. Frank, did you hear her?
I heard, yes.
I heard she did a great job.
She always does a great job.
All right, I want to make sure people can hear you. If the levels are good. Frank, you're speaking.
And
that's
I am.
Kind of interesting. Should we talk about that just a little bit?
If you want.
Oh, I think we should, because I have to turn my mic up now. This has been an interesting thing. I talked earlier with Matt Schlapp about CPAC. I talked about his leadership. And one of the big changes that doesn't involve your organizational interests was the whole thing about the log cabin Republicans and the dissonance over them being here with Christian conservatives. Matt came in and took a pretty good stand on that, and kind of, and then now this year was the Milo Yiannopoulos dust up about Milo's statements seeming to endorse pedophilia and priest boy sex abuse. But that's not the only issue over which there's been tremendous controversy at CPAC. And one of those issues that I've been in the thick of because of my friends like you, Frank, is the whole issue of this business of the Muslim Brotherhood. Who are they and who are they not? Have they infiltrated? Have they not? By the way, Frank Gaffney is my guest, and Frank is the founder and president of the Center for Security Policy. Frank has been the tip of the spear in briefing and consistently making it known who the Muslim Brotherhood really is. So, Frank, that translated to some really rocky times with this organization, didn't it?
It has. I'm very happy to say those times are behind us, though, Sandy. And I give Matt Schlapp and Dan Schneider, his executive director, tremendous credit for helping sort of get the ship back on the right course. And in particular, with respect to this really existential threat to our country. I don't just mean to the conservative movement, but to our country. And few people have understood this better or done more to help bring a level of awareness to our countrymen and women about this than you have, Sandy. So I'm so appreciative. As well, let me just say, for your putting my commentaries up each day, it's really a privilege. With respect to the Brotherhood, just a word or two, it's an organization that most of us, if we know anything about it at all, learned about in connection with the recent takeover of Egypt by
the Muslim Brotherhood
enterprise. Mm-hmm. And when I say enterprise, it's a better way of thinking of it than just a group, because it is truly the leading edge of what's been called the global Islamic movement or global jihadist movement, if you will. And it's gotten a pass in a lot of circles, including in our government, because it has ostensibly renounced violence. It's not supposed to be like Al-Qaeda or like the Islamic State or Taliban.
They're the tolerable Muslims because they're not violent.
Well, here's the kicker.
So goes
they want,
the story.
They want exactly the same thing as all of the groups I've just mentioned and many more. It is a Sharia supremacist group. Sharia being, of course, that totalitarian Islamic doctrine that would, if it were successful, transform the whole world into a Muslim-dominated state, if you will, a caliphate. And the Muslim Brotherhood's greatest menace, I think, to countries like ours is the extent to which it does what it does to advance that same goal that it shares with Al-Qaeda and so on through stealth, through subversion, through penetration and destroying countries from within. And that is exactly what they have in mind for us. And it's not just my say-so. The U.S. government in the Holy Land Foundation trial, the largest terrorism trial in our history, demonstrated this by introducing into evidence a secret plan written by one of the top Muslim Brotherhood operatives in this country, a fellow by the name of Mohammed Akram. So here at CPAC, we have tried over the years to expose people to this problem and found some pushback.
Because the infiltration was so successful, it even happened in conservative circles. And I would say we're not speaking past tense on all of that. It still exists.
Indeed.
It's a battlefront, and you've made some tremendous inroads by just constantly briefing, constantly speaking about it. I have to say that the explanatory memorandum, which is what you published it, but it's not you didn't write it. The Muslim Brotherhood wrote it. It was discovered in the Holy Land trial. There's nothing I've posted more on my Facebook page than the explanatory memorandum. In fact, we'll post it again today because we're having this conversation,
Thank
and
you.
Every time thousands of people read it, Frank. So. And so it's not your words. You just keep consistently saying that. Now, this has been a long process where we've drawn people over to this side of understanding about it, but we haven't succeeded. And right now with the Trump administration, this really is the defining issue in the national security apparatus. And in fact, he just chose General McMaster to be his, General Flynn understood this.
Mm-hmm.
He's no longer there, so then Trump has appointed McMaster to be his national security advisor. All right. What do we know about McMaster on this issue?
Let me just say, what we know about McMaster more generally is that he's a very formidable man, quite an intellect, an accomplished warrior, decorated for his service to our country in uniform, and he still wears the uniform of the United States Army. He's a lieutenant general, as you know. What is a little less clear, Sandy, and I'm reserving judgment on it at the moment. I want to see, what he decides and how he conducts himself in this new position of National Security Advisor. But what is an open question, I think, is when he did what he did, when he said what he said, during the Obama years in particular, as he came up the ranks of the military, about Islam, about, respecting Muslims, about the nature of the threat we're facing, in such a way as to conform with basically the guidance of the Obama administration, said Islam is a religion of peace, we are not at war with Islam, the Islamic State has nothing to do with Islam. And
he actually
said that.
Well, he said that, did he not?
The President of the United States said that. What we are working our way through is when General McMaster said things in keeping with the general thrust of what the President was saying, did he actually believe that? Is that his own core conviction, or was that something he had to say, to basically be consistent with civilian control of the military, which is a principle that I very much respect. And I've got friends on both sides of this question. We're watching and waiting. And you're right, Sandy. It is, I believe, the defining issue of our time. If you get this wrong, it is almost inconceivable that we can prevail against the existential threat posed to us by these Sharia supremacists. If you get it right, with the leadership of Donald Trump, which I would hope McMaster would be strongly supporting, I think we've got a chance. That's for sure.
The odd thing is that this is a time, a day and age, when the people in highest office, whether it's the FBI director or our generals, it's possible for them to be completely ignorant about this. Isn't it, Frank?
Well, it wouldn't be their fault entirely. I mean, I think they have a duty to know, and our friend Steve Coughlin has written a terrific book indicting them for not knowing, a professional responsibility that is being unfulfilled. But let's be honest, the Obama administration, and frankly, to some extent, the Bush administration before it, began essentially making it a career-ending offense if you actually sought to understand all of this, let alone act on it. They prevented people from using in the lexicon of the FBI and of the military and of the intelligence community and Homeland Security words like jihad. And Sharia, and you know, the idea that they had something to do with Islam, let alone terrorism. And as a result of that, and purging people who trained our military and other personnel on these matters, and the materials that they would use that would inform them about the truth, all of that went over the side. Not because it was politically incorrect, as we were led to believe, but really, at least as far as the Islamists were concerned, we were submitting to them. And that's what's so worrying about this, because as you know, we've talked about this many times, when you submit, when you, the infidel, submits, you wind up putting yourself in extreme jeopardy, because they interpret that as the flashing green light to double down. And that means almost certainly more violent behavior in the future.
And let's come back to that. But on the heels of that, then, this is like the divider in terms of discernment. And we both know many mutual friends who have lost their careers over just speaking the truth about this. And that comes back to you. You have been shunned by some over the past 10 years or more, including this organization. They just didn't want you to speak because you were, it was so radical what you were saying, but it wasn't radical at all. But now they're beginning to understand, and now you are fully back, and you're speaking, and Breitbart, we have to say, played a huge role in this too, Frank.
They did.
They held an off-campus, Steve Bannon, who is now the closest advisor to the president, arguably the same as Kelly, in terms of access, held an off-campus event here a couple of years ago that you hosted that featured this very thing. But think of the progress. I'm encouraged.
Me too.
But now we have an obstacle, because now Trump, I think, understands this, President Trump. At least he gets it in his gut, even though he might not be able to explain it with the words. But a lot of the people around him don't, and so there's a war between them. And so this is a problem.
Well, it is potentially fatal, quite frankly. I don't want to sound, you know, hyperbolic, but it is truly possibly fatal if we miss this opportunity to adopt the kind of course correction that Donald Trump explicitly embraced. And I keep drawing people's attention to an incredibly important speech that he made on this subject on the 15th of August of last year in Youngstown, Ohio, where he laid out what I think of as a victory plan over jihad, a strategy for accomplishing it. And it had the key components just right. And what we need now more than ever, Sandy, is for the people around him to help him execute that plan.
Okay, so Frank, there is this talk. It's not just talk. It's a piece of legislation sponsored by Ted Cruz and others in the House to designate the Muslim Brotherhood a terrorist organization. What do you know about that effort?
This bill, and I really commend Ted Cruz and Mario Diaz-Balart is the sponsor in the House for their initiative. They actually introduced it last year when there was no hope because the president wasn't about to sign it, even if it got through the Senate and House. This year, it could conceivably get through the Senate and House, and if it did, I'm reasonably sure that Donald Trump would sign it. But more to the point, it's actually unnecessary if the president will simply do what is entirely within his discretion to do, which is direct the Secretary of State, and he could also direct the Secretary of Treasury, because they each have sort of separate lists, that place formally the Muslim Brotherhood, this group that explicitly seeks to destroy us from within, on the list of what is called designated terrorist organizations. It should be there. It actually is a terrorist organization. All of the terrible groups that I mentioned a moment ago that are the violent kinds of jihadists are offshoots of the Muslim Brotherhood, inspired by the same agenda. This needs to be done. I am prayerful, Sandy, and I hope your audience will join us in a prayer on this, that in fact Donald Trump will do that. And it will be an early test of General McMaster if he supports him in that step.
You know, I was just thinking about our mutual friend Patrick Poole coming back from Egypt and talking about how the Egyptians, under Sisi, the leadership, were shocked, absolutely shocked, that the Muslim Brotherhood has full acceptance here. CARE, their mouthpiece, Council of American Islamic Relations, that nobody's doing anything because they understand fully what a terrorist group it is. And so that should tell us something. But that brings me back to this thing, Frank. really interesting little tidbits here. We got Keith Ellison, who is like the first Muslim elected to Congress from Minnesota, and he is supposedly the number one candidate to be the head of the DNC. Now, what do we know about Keith Ellison and any ties to the Muslim Brotherhood?
Well, let me just pick up on something you said a moment ago. I've just handed you a copy of a book that I commend to all of your listeners. And by the way, if they want to get access to these themselves, they simply need to go to securefreedom.org. They can download every one of our books for free there. The one I've just given you, Sandy, like the explanatory memorandum, came to light as a result of the Holy Land Foundation trial in 2007-2008. What this book is called, Care is Hamas. And it talks about the evidence that was introduced in that trial that was obtained through a wiretap of the organizational meeting of this group, the Council on American Islamic Relations, or CARE. And it couldn't have been more clear. It was founded by Hamas to raise money for the organization and to engage in what I think of as political warfare inside the United States. So to your question about Keith Ellison, CARE is one of a number of groups associated with the Muslim Brotherhood and or Hamas, its Palestinian franchise, that has been actively supported by and assisted by our prospective Democratic National Committee chairman, Keith Ellison.
Let's come back with that, Frank. I think I hear the music. It's difficult because it's just, these people are so noisy. I don't know why they won't be quiet for us while we're doing a radio show. My guest is Frank Gaffney, Center for Security Policy. Securefreedom.org is the website. You can get all kinds of great information there. And we'll be back right after this. Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.
Don't forget to connect with Sandy Rios in the morning on Facebook or email Sandy at sandy@afr.net. That's sandy@afr.net. Sandy Rios in the morning on American Family Radio.
All right, Sandy Rios back with you. Again, live from this very noisy Gaylord Hotel. All kinds of people walking back and forth from all over the country, young and old. A lot of young people here always, every year, and that's encouraging. And my guest is Frank Gaffney. You hear him every single morning on this show. I'm so honored to have Frank's commentary and his wisdom for at least 60 seconds every single morning. Frank is the founder of Center for Security Policy, and again, their website is securefreedom.org. That memorandum, explanatory memorandum that I post so often is a publication of theirs, but it was written by the Muslim Brotherhood. It's something that you need to get. And Frank mentioned a few minutes ago this other publication called Care is Hamas, which is also evidence from that Holy Land Foundation trial. Before the break, we were talking about Keith Ellison, who is the first Muslim elected Congress out of Minnesota. Well, first Muslim elected to Congress. He's out of Minnesota. And his entanglement with the Muslim Brotherhood, Frank, you were making the case, and let's pick that up.
Well, there are two Muslims in Congress now, and it might be worth mentioning the other one at the same time, Andre Carson of Indiana.
From Indiana.
Correct. These are two individuals who have, over the years, been involved in a whole array of radical causes. I know you know Trevor Loudon, the filmmaker and author and investigative reporter. He's done a marvelous job of documenting who these characters are. We've got a dossier on Andre Carson at our website, for example, as well. The short form of it is this, Sandy. They come out of Muslim organizations that have, like the Council on American Islamic Relations, long been associated with the Muslim Brotherhood. In fact, at the back of that book, the explanatory memorandum, there's a list under the heading Our Organizations and Organizations of Our Friends. And you go down that list, and quite a number of them have had Keith Ellison or Andre Carson or both as speakers at their events. They've gotten letters from them, or they've had fundraising support of one kind or another, or they've given money to them. And the trouble is, that is a national security problem, in my judgment. It is a problem if the guy becomes the chairman of the Democratic Party and he has these sorts of ties or these sorts of proclivities. It's a problem if he's the ranking member of the Emerging Threats Subcommittee of the House Intelligence Committee.
And he is.
Which
what is
what
he
Andre is. Carson is.
Yes.
And just get this, Andy, as we've been talking about off-air, Andre Carson is one of, by some estimates, 50, I've even heard a number as high as 100 Democratic members of the House of Representatives who had IT, information technology services, provided to them for some years now by one or more of a family of Pakistani expatriates. And at the moment, we don't frankly know a lot about this. My commentary is about it today. But the issue that I think we need to focus on is, what kind of information were those IT characters getting access to? Did it in some way, shape, or form teach them insights into what the House Intelligence Committee is doing, for example, by having access to Andre Carson's personal and official email accounts? I don't know. Were these individuals essentially making that information available to others? Again, we don't know.
Well, they
were these individuals perhaps coming from Pakistan, as they did, tied to the particularly aggressive and insidious intelligence service of Pakistan, the so-called ISI. Again, we don't know the answer to these questions, but I think it is high time that the Congress of the United States be holding open hearings on what is known about these individuals and what they did with the kind of access that they had.
Well, they're already under investigation and been... Look, they either are or are not fired. Depends on what you read. I guess they have to be fired by everyone, or they're not fired by anyone. That's the way I understand it. They're making inordinate amounts of money. That's even an issue, too, Frank. Like, one of them at 22 is making $170,000 a year as an IT person for the House of Representatives, hired by Debbie Wasserman Schultz, who was the chairman of the Democratic Committee, whose email was hacked. That was part of the reason why, well, they would say Hillary Clinton lost the election, mm-hmm. were these leaks. And it was these Pakistani. We know that they mishandled the information.
This raises yet another question, Sandy. We've been hearing a lot about Russian hacking of Debbie Wasserman Schultz and the DNC's emails. The question occurs, could these Pakistani types have had something to do with that breach of the information services of the Democratic National Committee? I don't know. But think about this. What happens if you have somebody running the DNC who is actually aligned with these, I think of them as Sharia supremacists, and it's a lot of dots that remain to be connected. Let me just stipulate to that. You're right. It is under investigation. We're being told by the always responsible, not always necessarily, but in this case, very responsible House of Representatives leadership, that we have to wait till the investigation's complete before we actually start looking into this ourselves. Well, I'm sorry. I think this is a serious counterintelligence problem, and I think we have a need to know that people are on top of it and exploring its implications.
Well, listen, they couldn't do it right now, Frank, because they had to take a 10-day break.
Oh, that's right. I'm sorry.
And then they have their 2-week vacation in April.
I forgot.
And, this is the seriousness with which the leadership of the House and the Senate are taking their jobs right now. Right. While this president is working around the clock, where they are stalling, they are going on vacation, they're concerned, they're going to disappoint their wives. We've actually heard one of them say that. Our wives are planning these vacations. We can't not do this. So the president doesn't have his staff, including national security, but they're on vacation.
Yeah. And Sandy, the flip side of not having his staff is he's got Barack Obama's staff. As we've been talking about, the bulk of the government at the moment is still in the hands of people who were brought into government by Barack Obama. And I think if most Americans who wanted a course correction understood that this government is still being managed. Let me give you one example, if I can. A man I know you admire and regard as highly as I do, Jeff Sessions, is now, thank God, the Attorney General of the United States. I'm quite certain Jeff Sessions doesn't know, or at least hasn't until very recently been aware, that one of the things that's happening is the Obama administration holdovers are still trying to punish communities that have raised quite legitimate concerns about having jihadist mosques imposed upon them. And the Justice Department, as under Obama, is now trying to sue or otherwise coerce those communities into acceding to that that submission. And I think that's, again, the right term for this. So Jeff Sessions desperately needs help. He needs a new civil rights assistant attorney general.
But no, Frank, Congress has to take their break. And they have to have their vacations or their wives will be mad at them.
Yeah.
Seriously, I'm not even trying to make a joke. I'm telling you the truth. This is the fecklessness with which this Congress, under these circumstances, face their duties. They are derelict. And will you please make a mental note, whoever your congressperson is, they are all complicit in this, and there are very few good ones. And so it's time to clean house, I have to say. The president may not be able to get anything done this cycle. They're just dragging their feet on everything, Frank.
But if you think about it, Sandy, I'm sorry to say, and there are some good people,
I
know.
Did I say that?
I'd like not to see all of them swept out with the broom, but let's be honest. The good ones are not able to call the shots in most cases. They're being told what they can do and when they can do it by the leadership. And the leadership has to be held accountable because, as Donald Trump has said, they're part of the problem. Now, unfortunately, he's trying to get along with them because he does need their help. But I'm afraid that if he doesn't apply the whip, and if, more to the point, the American people don't hold these elected representatives accountable, I would respectfully suggest they not simply make a mental note, but they get on the phone and raise a little hell with their representatives. Maybe they'll be having a town hall meeting. They'd have to compete, of course, with the hard left for airtime during those meetings, the town hall meeting. But get in front of these people. They represent you and demand that they help Donald Trump take advantage of the brief window in which he's likely to be able to get anything done, which is, frankly, closing quickly.
I was thinking how ironic. They could agree with the far left on this. They could all unite under this one thing, do your job.
Amen.
Yeah, they could agree about that.
Amen.
Hey, Frank, if the Muslim Brotherhood is designated a terrorist organization, let's say that should happen, and Keith Ellison is the head of the DNC, and Andre Carson is a high-ranking member of the Intelligence Committee, what would that do? What would happen?
It gives us an opportunity to damage control, Sandy. At the moment, we have essentially no instruments at all, other than just to try to raise public awareness and outrage. And speaking of outrage, it will be an outrage if the Democrats actually elect a Muslim Brotherhood affiliate, if not operative, to their chairmanship. But what you could do in a circumstance where they're a designated terrorist organization is you can begin rolling them up. You can begin taking down mosques or Islamic societies or Islamic cultural centers or Muslim Brotherhood front groups like the Council on American Islamic Relations. And let's be honest, they will put up a fight over that that will make the current fracas about the immigration executive orders pale by comparison. But it is a necessary step. Think about this, and you and I are, you're not quite as old as I am. You're much better preserved.
But you're
close to being of an age, and you certainly are read enough in history to remember that when you had fifth columnists of the communists operating in this country, we took steps to try to shut that down. When we had the Bund of Nazi Germany operating in this country, we took steps to shut it down. We didn't bring more of them in, for one thing. We were screening for that. We need to be doing the same sorts of things, I believe, with these jihadists in our midst. And there will be lots of people who say, well, you can't do that because their faith gives them protection under our Constitution. And as you and I have discussed many times, and I just would shortly give your audience the distilled essence of the best argument in countering that, I think, and that is, properly understood, what is animating these guys, whether they're the violent jihadists or the stealthy kind, is Sharia. Sharia is not a religion. It has a patina of religiosity to it, but it is fundamentally a political, military, and legal program aimed at dominating the entire world and destroying countries that stand in their way like ours. So those who adhere to Sharia, those who are believing whatever it is, their God's direction or whatever, that that's what they must do, actually are pursuing a seditious totalitarian program. And we have laws to protect against that. We don't have to protect them in trying to take us down.
Would you say Sharia is more like thinking about it in terms of communism is the better way to think about it? Communism doesn't play well. Yeah, with a God. Well, the state was God with communism. So,
but this is with an actual divinity,
yeah.
And therefore, because we have under our
First
constitution
Amendment rights to, yeah.
viewed it as a religion instead of the totalitarian ideology it is, we've gotten in greater jeopardy than we'd otherwise
were. So we have to refine our understanding and refine our laws.
Absolutely.
So they're free to worship Allah. They're not free to embrace Sharia to the detriment of the Constitution of the American way of life.
Yes.
So that's
our colleague Steve Coughlin has said very succinctly, the part of Islam that is religious practice is protected. The part that is seditious, totalitarian subversion is not. And that's the way to think of it, I think.
Frank, is it possible to do extreme vetting, as the president talks about, to Muslims coming into this country? Is it possible to really discern?
I think if you use Sharia as the filter, you can do a lot. What you really need with vetting is a background investigation. And that's almost impossible in most of the countries in which
we're looking. Because they don't have the records, the records are
destroyed. And our people can't go in and find the information they need.
All right. Well, securefreedom.org is the website. And Frank, as always, you have just been a lone wolf at times, but I think you're gaining ground, and I'm glad to have helped you do that. So I'm glad you're back at CPAC speaking, and thanks for all you've done. And by the way, this explanatory memorandum will be on our Facebook page, and also we'll link to this Care is a Must book so that you can have access to both of them. Frank, thanks so much.
Bless you.
All right, Sandy Rios coming to you. Be back tomorrow. Sandy Rios and CPAC at CPAC.